Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Signals from the Hill, a podcast about comics from Avery Hill Publishing. I'm Ricky Miller, co-publisher at Avery Hill. In this episode, we've got a conversation with the genius comics creator George Wallace as we celebrate the release of his book Curses, a new collection of his short stories. If you haven't read it yet, then you need to check it out, along with his previous books, Internet Crusader and 2120. George has been developing a serious cult following since we published his first book back in 2017, leading to 2120, his comics role-playing game, becoming a smash hit for us last year. I discussed with George the culture that has influenced him and fed into his work, from horror movies to video games and avant-garde music. Here it is. Hi, George, how are you?
Hey, good. How are you?
I am very well. Where are you at the moment?
I'm in my studio in Baltimore.
How long have you lived in Baltimore for?
10 years now. Actually,
Okay.
2024 will be 10 years. Yeah.
Cool. Tell us a bit about Baltimore, about your neighborhood.
Yeah, I live in a neighborhood called Hamden in Baltimore. It's very kind of like a hip, cool neighborhood. It's kind of like the Brooklyn of Baltimore, but much smaller. Yeah, it's a really cool city. People always ask me if it's like The Wire, very famous show that was set here, The Wire. And I always say, yeah, it's exactly like The Wire. I haven't watched much of The Wire, but yeah, that's kind of our claim to fame. But it's also it's kind of a port city in between Washington and New York. We're really close to Washington, about an hour away. Smallish city. I really like living here. I don't know. It's very cool. It's small, but it also has that kind of big city conveniences. Yeah.
Great. So we've been working with you for, I don't know what, it must be about 7 years now, I guess.
Yeah.
The first book we did was Ghosts, etc., which was a collection. Then we did Internet Crusader, then 2120, and now we just had Curses come out, which is a kind of expansion of Ghosts, etc., plus some new strips and things. And you've been on, I think you've been on this podcast probably twice, maybe. I think Steve,
Couple times I talked to Steve and Jack. I think I talked to Steve twice. Yeah.
I think you probably did. So we're not going to do what J.D. Salinger called all the David Copperfield crap. We're going to
Yeah, that's good.
just kind of launch into doing something a bit different, which we've only done once before, which is. We're going to go through and talk about how different cultural things that are important to you have kind of influenced your work. The brief was for you to pick a film, a piece of music, or an album or something, a book. We said the comic, but then we switched it to a video game for you, which is probably more or equally appropriate anyway, and a TV show. And the idea is that we discuss how they've influenced your work, but also what that possibly says about aspects of your work and you. And so I think what we'll do is, firstly, do you actually watch or consume any culture while you're working? Do you like watch TV or listen to
No.
music or no? So you just go straight
No,
into
I
it.
Yeah, I mean, I have music on in the background usually while I'm working, either on comics or just professional illustration stuff, or just podcasts. But I don't really find that kind of thing too inspiring to the work. I mean, so much of like doing any kind of artwork or comic or illustration is just like grinding it out. Like after a while, it just you just have to sit down and like draw the same thing 100 times. So I'm almost on autopilot at that point, and I don't take too much inspiration, in the moment. So it can be different if you're doing like a painting, like an abstract painting or something where you're moving around, it's physical. But yeah, it's usually just kind of background noise that's in the back.
Sure. Just before we start, I guess the main thing before we go through all of them, the main thing they all have in common is horror elements.
Yeah.
Is horror a big thing for you? You say, are you a horror nerd, or is it just something that you just latch on to in different things.
It's like a very specific kind of horror. Like, I feel really bad. You know, like I sent you the list of the stuff we're going to talk about, and I didn't think too much about it. I just kind of wrote down the most influential stuff. And then when I came back to our email chain, I was like, oh my God, that is so bleak and depressing. This
I'll say the
poor
mute.
you have to like read all this.
I'll say the music piece
The
was tough.
music. Yeah,
That
very, very
was
tough. Yeah, for
tough.
sure. No, it's I like horror, but I don't like I don't like being scared, you know.
Right.
So I like horror that's a little more like kind of artsy, and it's a little more kind of visual focused or conceptual rather than just like kind of screaming in your face. But I've kind of always been into it, even when I was like a little kid, you know. So I started when I was like too young. I read like every Stephen King book that he wrote
Sure.
from the time I was in like sixth grade, like maybe 12, to the time I was like in high school, maybe like 14. So I definitely is part of it for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have a kind of similar relationship with horror to you then. Like I like the Stephen King books and I kind of like low level scares like arachnophobia. But other than that, it's more the kind of creepy, kind of subversive type stuff that I'm into. And
Dread,
so,
yeah.
which your first choice, which is a film, is a great example of. So, would you like to tell us what that is?
Yeah, so I picked The Shining, probably the most like famous and well-known work on this list. Obviously a movie based on a Stephen King novel. Came out in what, the 80s, 70s? I don't know.
Yeah, I think early 80s, yeah.
80s. I'm not a huge like film and TV person. I don't watch a lot of film or TV. But thinking about this list was a really good exercise in kind of identifying some moments that were really influential to me. I started with The Shining because when I was a kid, my grandparents had a like a cabin in the mountains in Pennsylvania. And I mean, I loved going up there, but it was, night times were very boring because there was no TV or anything to do. They had this ancient TV from like the 70s, and they had three videotapes to watch. Ben-Hur. A kid doesn't want to watch Ben-Hur. The Shining, right? And Austin Powers, right? So between The Shining and Austin Powers, I feel like my life could have gone in two different directions. So I must have watched The Shining like, 100 times, or at least parts of it, because it was the only thing available. And I was just rewatching part of the clips of it today and kind of reading about it. I have all these notes here about everything.
Right.
It really kind of, I feel like, influenced me a lot. There's like the liminal horror, right? Like the hallways and the emptiness of the Overlook Hotel. There's like the mazes and stuff. But also like that sense of dread where like there's not a lot of jump scares in that movie, but I do feel like it's very scary in places because it's bit like there's so much build up. You have the kid riding down the hallway endlessly, and then it gets to the creepy girls and it just like stays there for a while and you're just like looking at them, right? Like those moments where like we can just like it's not a jump scare because it doesn't flash at you. It's like it's on the screen for a while. There's a build up to it that I really like that's something that's really interesting. Like the scene in the bathroom where the woman is walking to you like very slowly and something's gonna happen. I
Yeah.
find that like very compelling, in setting a scene. I also really like the beauty, like the hotel is beautiful, right? The architecture is really nice, the color is gorgeous. And then there's like compositionally, there's like one horrifying thing in the scene. That's like a really interesting way to compose an image for me, right? If you took like a still frame of like that bathroom where the woman's walking towards you, like it's this gorgeous room. But there's like this one horrifying element in the middle of it. Just like on an artistic sense, I find that really inspiring for like making a composition,
Yeah, I mean, you don't do quite that though with your work, do you? It's more the horrifying thing, but in a mundane kind of setting, like or kind of shabby, run down kind of settings.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, maybe those environments came from like life a little bit more. But like in terms of, you know, if you look at Kubrick, like the way he composes like a scene, you know, there's like symmetry, like everything's kind of perfect. It's angular. I feel like that kind of sensibility came into my work pretty strongly.
Yeah, I mean, when you mentioned this film, I was like, oh, of course.
Yeah,
It was
right.
just like
Yeah.
I was, it kind of made me think of like there's a lot of door openings as well, which is obviously like
Right.
obviously a very basic level in 2120. There is that with just the creepiness of what could be behind there, and then just yeah, you tend to like centralize that whatever it is in the kind of middle of it, and yeah, it definitely. Now you mentioned the lady who is in the room. That kind of aspect towards the end of 2120, and of course a kind of big kind of party ballroomy scene as well. Some of the dancing in 2120, that kind of made me think of that as well. Do you feel like I'm trying to think of. Have you ever like directly referenced it, do you think, or is it just kind of
No, I it's weird. I didn't even think of The Shining as an influence until like, you know, we had that email chain just a few weeks ago. But now that I think about it, it really is pretty influential to me. I didn't take anything. I took a lot of 2120 from other sources, especially Silent Hill, which we'll talk about later. But the ballroom scene in 2120 was actually like the first image I had in mind when I started drafting the book. I don't really know where it came from. I think I drew like a dancer, just sketched it once, and I was like, that's weird. Like she's kind of dancing in this empty room. And then like 2120 kind of built out from there. That was like the very first scene. And then actually, like when we get to the music really heavily references The Shining and the ballroom scene, and that musician talks a lot about like the grand ballroom in The Shining, and how that kind of influences his work. And then I was kind of influenced by that when I was researching 2120. So it there's like a very clear like through line, I think.
Yeah. I mean, like you, I hadn't thought about it until you said it, and then I was like, oh yeah,
Yeah.
it
Makes a
feels
lot of
almost too
sense. Yeah.
perfect, especially
Yeah.
the
Yeah.
corridors. There's a lot of corridors, obviously, in 2120. But
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, let's kind of go on then to like let's jump ahead and talk about, since you mentioned the video game, Silent Hill 2, which I've never played, but I did some research on. So
Yeah.
yeah, tell us about Silent Hill 2.
So, Silent Hill 2. Man, I could do a whole podcast about this game. I love Silent Hill 2. I think it's a masterpiece, right? I think, you know, it's like one of the best games as an art form ever made. It's just amazing. It came out in 01, 2001 for PlayStation. It tells the story of this guy who gets a letter from his dead wife that says like, oh, I miss you, like come visit me in our special place. And the guy, the main character that you play as, James, is like, what is this letter from my dead wife who died like 5 years ago or whatever. So he goes to Silent Hill where they had like a vacation or something, and it's like this horror town, right? It's like this horrible nightmare town full of monsters, and all the architecture is like rusted, and like things are covered up with sheets of plastic tarps. It's just like very disturbing and surreal. And when you play it, like when you first play it or when you look at it, you think like, oh, this is just like some horror game, like a zombie game, like there are these kinds of monsters walking around. But it's like it's way more than that. And that's kind of like the through line with all these works where, you know, it kind of presents itself as one thing, but it's really about something else. So, you know, he's going through Silent Hill, the town, and you know, he's trying to find his dead wife who he like misses very much. And it's really like the town is kind of like his psyche, right? And like everything that's like in the town is part of his like you know is part of his consciousness or his psyche. And you know the story then unfolds that he had to like mercy kill his wife because she was like dying of cancer and she was like really suffering. And he had all these like feelings of guilt, but he also had these feelings of like sexual, you know, frustration that he couldn't, you know, sexually be with his wife because she was dying, and the guilt that come with that. And then there's like all these other kind of like emotions in it. And, you know, the game is really this journey about like this guy's descent into like guilt. And then all the like weird creatures are different aspects of his psyche. So the main bad guy, the main antagonist in this is this like voiceless character called Pyramid Head, this giant guy with like this giant pyramid cage on his head that kind of just torments James. And that's like his manifestation of his like need to be punished for Mercy killing his wife. It's like so deep and there's like so many layers to it. And I really like really love that. Yeah. So when I made, so when I was doing 2120 specifically, I was really like, I couldn't get the game out of my head. I played through it multiple times as like a teenager. And what I really liked about it is like, there's so much in there that's these kind of like random things. Like all the puzzles in the game kind of don't make that much sense. And there's like random things left behind. And, you know, you'll open a door in this like nightmare, like horrible place, and then there's just like a guy sitting there eating pizza, or just like a lady laying on the bed or whatever. And like that sense of like you're going through this world that you don't understand, but there's like people living in it as well, was like a huge influence on 2120, right? Like if you go through 2120, you know, you open some random door like 400 pages in and there's like a person there, right? That kind of all came out of Silent Hill 2.
Sure. And yeah, and the I was kind of interested in the kind of games and puzzles and things like that in it. Was that an influence as well?
Yeah, heavily. So when I was making 2120 and I was like inventing the codes and stuff in the game, I was actually playing Silent Hill 1, which is very similar. It's just that 2 is better, and the puzzles are like really weird. They kind of subvert your expectations. I remember there was this one puzzle, I think it was in Silent Hill 1, where it's like a piano. And you have to play the right keys on the piano to like open a door or something. And you don't play the music. There's like a couple broken keys. And you press the broken keys of the piano and then the door opens. And I'm like, wow, that is so like different than what I was expecting. And I really like that. There's a lot of parts in the game where it's like, you know, you're going down a hall and then there's just like a wall where there should be a hall, right? And so like there was a lot of that in 2120 where I would just like block something off. It also like it tells the story very differently, right? Where in a traditional horror game, you know, you have a bad guy chasing you and you have to fight it, and that's scary, right? In Silent Hill 2, there's one scene where you leave and then in the hallway out of nowhere there's like bars that weren't there before, and behind the bars is like the main bad guy, Pyramid Head, and he just stands there. Like he doesn't threaten you or anything, he can't attack you because there's bars in the middle of it, but just like introducing something and leaving it there and not like playing into the horror tropes was really, really influential. And that's kind of influenced my thinking when I was just like kind of writing the book.
Something really just occurred to me that Internet and Crusader and 2120 are both games essentially. Like in the Internet Crusader is obviously a big half of the book is first person computer game, and then obviously the whole format of 2120 is based around kind of choose your own adventure type books. Is gaming your passion? Is that kind of what how you come at things?
Yeah, I love video games. I always have. I've been into them since I was a kid. And I think they really influenced my work a lot. I realized that about those two books. And then I thought, okay, well, like this could just be my inspiration, right? I could just be inspired by games. You know, it's fine. I actually did an interview with someone from, I think, a French art magazine or something, who was like asking me to write all this about like the connection between comics and games. And I do feel like there is a good connection because it is kind of just another way to visually tell a story. So yeah, definitely. And actually, like, you know, I didn't watch a lot of TV growing up. I still don't really watch TV or movies. So like my big influences come from like books and games, which is like my main kind of entertainment stuff, you know.
Cool. Let's go on to the book then.
Yeah, sure.
What did you choose?
Yeah, so I chose House of Leaves by Mark Danielewski. Might not be pronouncing that right. It's a really good book. It's a book that really influenced 2120 specifically, but I think my art practice in general a lot. I read it right after we did maybe Ghost, etc. I remember, yeah, I read it in my wife's old apartment, so it would have been like 2017. And it was super influential because it's this big,
Sorry,
thick
I'm just
book.
laughing about that because I do this as well. It's like you remember when you read something by like where you were. I kind of do something very similar with like TV shows, and it's like I was like, oh yeah, Amy, I was in Amy's flat, and
So that would have been like 20, whatever. Well, I remember I read this book in my wife's apartment, which was this big old row home in Baltimore, which was very creepy and scary. And it was huge. And there were all these like back there was like a couple sets of steps. There was like all these hallways, all the rooms connected. And it was like mostly empty. And I was like, oh, this is exactly like the book. I would like freak out, wouldn't go downstairs, you know. Anyway. The book is like this multi-layered narrative. It's really hard to read. It's not a beach read for sure. I read it pretty thoroughly, and I think I only got like 10% of it. And that's fine. I really like that about it. It was a hard read. It was like you had to work to do it. And when, you know, I read through it, it's like an experience. It's like playing a game. It's like an experience where you have to figure it out and go back and forth. And I was like, oh, I want to do this with my readers, right? I want to have this experience where it's more than you're just like skimming through a comic at light speed, right? You actually spend some time going back and forth. In this story, there's like four narratives. The main thing that's always pitched is it's this story about a guy who moves in, a family who moves into a house, and they discover that the house is bigger inside than it is on the outside. And there are these There's like a closet that opens up, and there are these like endless hallways that keep expanding and growing and changing, with like no visual features at all. It's just kind of this black hallway. So that's like kind of the main narrative of it. And then like that narrative was compiled by this dead guy who lived in an apartment, who had all these like stacks of papers and stuff that someone who's like renting that apartment or lives in that apartment complex is like looking at all that stuff. And then is having like his own kind of experience in the world. And then his mother gets involved somehow. Like there's just so many layers to this, right? Like the book itself is kind of like a maze, and it's a book kind of about a book about a maze, right? It's hard to talk about, right? Because there's like so much to it. But what I really like took away from it and what really influenced me was the work it takes to kind of understand it, I found really fun and confusing and interesting. I took away from it that like parts of it, you know, are written upside down. You have to turn the book around. Sometimes there's only like one word on a page. You know, just formatting, like you can play with formatting, right? And then the last thing is like the author always calls it like it's a love story disguised as a horror story. And I really like that framing as well, like that tonal complexity. Where it kind of feels like one thing, but it's actually about something else. I found really interesting and, you know, deeper than just, you know, a horror novel about, you know, a monster or something. Yeah. Sorry, I could like kind of go on and on, but
It kind of one of the things I kind of thought about with it was there's this kind of this vast labyrinth inside, but there's a claustrophobic effect with it, which again is very 2120, I think, in that there is endless rooms and corridors and things, but you still feel trapped, you feel oppressed, and yeah, I was kind of was wondering about that in 2120, how you kind of achieved that. Is it the narrowness of the corridors? Is it the physical side of it, or? or the repetition?
Yeah, I think it's like the repetition is a big thing. Like in this book, you know, I was just reading this, I was reading parts of it just to kind of prepare for this talk. And there's one sequence where the guy Navidson, who lives in the maze house, goes on an expedition with like a bike and all these supplies and gets just like trapped in the maze like forever. And how like I couldn't put it down. I meant to just read a page or two, and I was like read the whole thing in like an hour, like this whole sequence. And it's like this endless thing that you can't get out of. So you feel very like trapped with no hope of exiting, in this case the maze. But in 2120, I wanted to have that same feel where like when I was drafting it, there was a couple of times where I kind of wanted the character to go back, like go upstairs, go back to the entrance or something. And it didn't read right because it didn't have that like claustrophobia, right? It's like you have to just keep going through the building until you find a way, find if there is a way out, you know? Yeah.
And that, of course, takes us back to The Shining as well, which is has a very similar thing about it, with a kind of endless maze of corridors, but the fact they're
Yeah.
trapped inside, essentially, and yeah, the claustrophobia and madness that ensues from that as well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and even in The Shining, I mean, like, you know, it ends in a maze, and I forgot that part. I really liked that. You know, I remember watching it and being very
Yeah.
intrigued by like this hedge maze, you know, so I think that might be, you know, part of it too.
Did you get lost in a maze as a child once? Is
No, I mean, maybe could be some
this your
repressed
origin
thing
story?
from some hay maze in the Poconos or whatever. But but it is like I worked in hospitals for so long, which the basements are so like labyrinth, and there were some times, especially at Johns Hopkins, where I was like, how do I get to where I want to go? Like I literally need to get to like this building, the second floor, and I cannot figure out how to get there from here. So the sense of like walking down the hallways, like what, like, well, if I turn this way, will it take me there? Like, I think that was actually like a very interesting, you know, part of it too.
George, the code was in a vending machine. You should know that.
Yeah, I
That was how
know
you got
that vending
into
machine.
that.
Dude, that vending machine was the vending machine I went to at the hospital all the time. Like I knew the way to get to that specific vending machine, right? So all this actually came from, you know, real life.
Okay, let's deal with the music now. It just made me feel really bad. When I kind
Yeah.
of read about what it was all about and then listened to it.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you'd like to explain.
Yeah, so I chose actually, what is this called?
At the end
Everywhere at
of
the End of
Time.
Time, right? There's another one called Everywhere in Empty Bliss or something like that. Everywhere at the End of Time by The Caretaker, a British musician who makes these experimental, I don't know, albums. I don't know what you would call it. Works of music, I guess, where he samples like old ballroom music and swing music and stuff like that, and kind of layers them up. This piece was I don't really know where to start. So this piece was about it's about dementia, right? It's about like kind of descending into dementia. It's very sad and hard to listen to. He takes these samples, and you know, the piece starts off with like kind of normal sounding ballroom music. There's a little bit of static, and eventually over the course of 6 hours, it fully degrades into kind of nothing, like static and little jumbles of sound and stuff. It's kind of about the descent from, you know, lucidity and clarity into like total dementia, and how, you know, your life kind of ends at that point. It's very hard to listen to. It's sad and scary. And when I was researching 2120, and I started with that ballroom scene, I forget. I think I was looking for visual references of like ballrooms and stuff, and I stumbled across this music somewhere online, and the artist, the caretaker, speaks a lot about how he was really influenced by The Shining, right, and by the ballroom scenes in there, and how he was trying to capture that like forgotten, like old period of time that you can never get back, or how things might be frozen in time, like those people are kind of ghosts in The Shining and they're frozen in that ballroom like forever. And that was like such an eerie parallel to like exactly what I was drawing at that time of this endless ballroom. And so I was listening to the music on Bandcamp, and my poor wife, who's this upbeat, happy woman who just wants to listen to like smooth jazz or happy music, 6 hours of The Caretaker. We share a studio and she's just like so upset. And actually I was listening to it today and she's like, oh, this again. But then like the music itself is really beautiful and sad. It's not something you would put on to, you know, work out or something, but it's something you listen to get yourself into a headspace. But the art that goes along with it is awesome. It's just amazing. I really love the visual artist who did all the packaging for their art is named Ivan Seal. He's an abstract painter. I actually have a book of the, they had an exhibit, right, where they played the music and they had his artwork shown, and I bought the exhibit catalog, and it's amazing. He paints these artworks, you know, these figures or whatever, that are kind of inspired by memory, right? Like you try to remember what someone looked like and you can never really quite get it right. So there are these like semi-abstract, semi-realistic paintings of, you know, a person or, you know, an object or whatever that kind of comes from, you know, the degradation of memory and put together in a package. Like this is such a beautiful artwork, right? The music, the artwork and the design of everything, you know, as a graphic designer, like it's an amazing piece of artwork. So, you know, I was just really influenced by that kind of whole package way of thinking about a project, the visuals and the sounds. I don't listen to this regularly, but you know, listening to it today, it's really striking, like how good it is, how beautiful of an artwork it is. I think it's like 15 discs or something. It's 6 hours long, and each kind of stage is like the stages of dementia.
I think it's six stages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's disc E. It's like, it says it on Bandcamp. It's like E, you know, the track name. Like that, like those letter E's are really good because they're like representational enough that you can kind of follow the music, but it starts glitching and it starts kind of degrading a little bit more obviously, so you're kind of right in that in between time, and it's definitely worth a listen, you know, if you want to get into my headspace, you know. So.
Okay, that's finished then on the TV show you chose, which is one of my absolute favorites, so I was very happy you chose that.
Yeah. The Leftovers was on HBO from 2014 to 2017, I think. This show is about one day, actually, and this is what makes it interesting. So one day, 2% of the world's population just suddenly disappears, right? It's called the departure date or something like that. The departure date, 2% of the world's population just disappears into thin air. No one can find them. The date that happens in the show is my birthday, right? So like, that for, like when I first started watching it, I was like, oh, this is like the perfect show. Man, just a great show, honestly. Like all these other things are pretty hard to like watch, maybe not The Shining, but the rest of them, you know, House of Leaves, Everywhere at the End of Time, and Silent Hill 2 are like hard to get through. They're very sad and bleak. The Leftovers is just like a really good show. It's like super underrated for some reason, but it's like consistently ranked as like one of the best shows ever. It's just really good. What happens after the people depart is, you know, all this kind of religious stuff comes up, cults come up, and there's like this guy proclaiming to be the new Jesus, and there's all these like spirituality things and stuff like that. I'm kind of fuzzy on it now. I haven't watched it in a while, but you know, the show centers on this cop who's like the main character. And he's, I guess, just trying to figure out like what happened, or, you know, where his family went, or like, or no, like his family is kind of taking all these different paths, right? Like the kid, like one of the kids goes to join the second Jesus. And I think the wife maybe joins the cult or something. I'm really fuzzy on the details, but it was like the first work that I watched that really brings into focus like all these different like religious beliefs and stuff, which has always been a thing for me. And seeing how you can, you know, build a artwork out of like cults and conflicting religious beliefs and like mystery. Like there's huge mysteries going on. I just really like that. There's one scene where, you know, the main character goes to like, I guess like a purgatory or like an afterlife. And he's like forced to sing karaoke to get out, which sounds really ridiculous when you say it out loud. But when you watch it, it's like the saddest, like most affecting scene in the show. Like I remember, like I've never watched a show and like cried, but I was like almost moved to tears at this one part because it was just so, so good. So like there are these like kind of talismanic things that happen in that show that, you know, something kind of random like karaoke is given this like huge heavy meaning. And I really like that kind of symbolism. So yeah, that was my choice for that.
And I guess, I mean, there's this kind of air of just sadness throughout the whole thing. Like yeah. Everyone is just very sad constantly throughout the whole show. It's that just it's deep. It just runs.
Yeah. Like, it's like very deep. Like, but the thing that's really good about it is like it's so watchable, you know, like it's compelling. A very entertaining show for like for anyone to watch, where like some of these other things definitely take some work. I would say it's like it's definitely even more watchable than like The Shining, which is very slow and kind of scary. But there it is like a sad show, but it has that entertaining element of it. And that's like another thing that I wanted to kind of do with my work, where like there is like kind of bigger themes, but it is also like kind of readable and interesting. Yeah.
Great. Well, readable and interesting. I think that's a good way to end then.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Cool.
It could be neat. I mean, you know, 2120 is very hard and it, you know, it may not be interesting. There's like 400 pages of hallways. So it could be the opposite.
Excellent. All right. Cheers, George. Thank you very much.
All right, Ricky.